702. The Naked Scientist.
Time for The Naked Scientist with Dr. Chris Smith. We take all of your science-related questions. Get in touch with us. Give us a call. 011-883-0702 and the WhatsApp line 072-702-1702. Doctor, how are you doing? Happy Monday.
Yeah, happy Monday to you too. I'm good. You?
I am good. And did you do your homework for today?
Well, I was going to write a letter of apology, actually, because I've had to come to class minus my homework, and the dog did not eat it.
I was about to say, did the dog eat your homework?
No, the dog did not eat the film I had to watch. I just haven't had a chance. I've been doing a lot of clinical duties, and I have not had a chance to settle down and do anything other than work.
Fortunately, movies are there literally forever, and because we always get questions about space, there will be ample time for us to have a conversation around that. But let's jump straight into the questions that have started to come through. One says, 702 listeners, please ask the Naked Scientist, why do people feel itchy and start scratching themselves? What is happening in the body? This is from Mjindi from Kagiso.
Hello, mate. Well, the answer is that we feel itchy because we have a population of nerve cells supplying our skin and connecting to a specific set of targets in the spinal cord that are exclusively itch-sensitive nerves. And when they become active, they are basically signalling to the central nervous system that this patch of the skin they supply has an itch associated with it. And they use a particular class of nerve transmitter chemicals to tell the spinal cord and then higher parts of the brain, this patch of your body is itchy. And you turn off that signal when you scratch, because when you scratch, you recruit pain nerve fibers, because scratching is to a certain extent painful. And the pain nerve fibers feed back onto the itch nerve fibers and inhibit them and turn off the signal. So why do we have this? It's almost like a red light that comes on the dashboard with a reset button next to it. And the red light is the itch and the reset is you scratching. It draws your attention to a certain part of the body, and this is a warning to you. It's something is wrong with this area. Something is irritating it. A parasite may be trying to drill holes in you, get into your body, lay eggs in you, etc. So it's a way of alerting you to something, some bit of mischief with some part of your body. And most itch is because of the chemical histamine. This is held in big cells called mast cells, which are present in all the parts of the body where our inside meets the outside world. So skin is a good example. Conjunctiva, the whites of your eyes and the eyelids, which get very itchy when you have hay fever, for example. Places like that. And where you get parasites or other nasties or infections trying to get through the skin, they run into these mast cells. The mast cells contain granules packed full of histamine as well as other things. And when the mast cells are impacted by parasites, other nasties, even physical perturbation, or an antibody bound onto their surface seeing something that you're allergic to, an IgE antibody seeing a pollen grain, for example, it makes the cell discharge all this histamine. And the histamine has a whole range of functions, including opening up blood vessels, making blood vessels leaky, but it also activates these itch-sensitive nerve endings, and that makes you then pay attention to that bit of your body. Something's wrong there. Pay attention to it. And so that's how you basically itch in response to a stimulus. And that's why antihistamines stop you itching if you take them before the problem, because you load up the system, block all the receptors for histamine. And even though you still get a release of histamine, your body can't see the histamine because the antihistamines have blinded you to the signal and you don't know that that patch of skin or your eyes are itchy.
Thank you so much for that question. There's another interesting one. That says, what is the probability of freezing my brain and coming back to life when technology allows? And it's so funny. I just happened to stumble upon Austin Powers. I think it might have been Gold Member or the one afterwards where Dr. Evil gets defrosted.
Yeah.
And there's many movies. There's an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. There's a Sylvester Stallone movie where people get frozen and they come back. How far are we from that even being a remote possibility?
Well, it's a bit like saying, can we travel in time? The answer is yes, in one direction. We haven't found reverse yet. People are freezing their bodies and their brains. Some people are just electing to freeze their heads. Some are electing to freeze their entire body. And they do this on the basis on the assumption that one day medical science will have progressed to the extent that we will be able to reanimate people who have died and been frozen in this way. There are mechanisms for putting people into this sort of embalming fluid, which is in theory able to prevent some of the damage that being frozen would normally do to your body. But if you think about how delicate your tissues are, if you are not careful and you just freeze your body, then imagine a strawberry put into the freezer and then defrosted. It doesn't look much like a nice, healthy strawberry.
I love that example.
And the same thing happens with all your tissues.
Gosh.
Because when you plunge yourself into the low temperature, your cells start to make ice. The ice inside your cells uses pure water, which leaves a strong salt solution behind inside the cells. So the salt solution pulls in more water. And that then turns into more ice, which then pulls in more water, which turns into more ice. And your cells all go pop because basically they've swollen up too much. And this is why strawberries deteriorate. There are fluids you can use if you can get them into all the cells, which are cryopreservatives, and they can help with this, but it's not perfect. And so the best we can do at the moment are freezing things like single cells, like eggs and sperm. We can do that very well. You can freeze an embryo, an early embryo with a handful of cells in it, by embalming the cells in this particular fluid, which protects them from these effects of ice and freezing, and then you put them at a very low temperature. But it's much more difficult to do this for whole big organisms or entire bodies. And so as a result of that, we have not succeeded in doing this, except where nature does it for us. And there are some frogs and some fish that can tolerate being frozen in this way, and they have evolved really clever chemistry. These frogs, for example, you see in David Attenborough's films that freeze solid. They do this by making chemicals in their cells that make them freeze really, really well. Most people think they've got some kind of antifreeze. They haven't. They've actually got pro-freezing chemicals, and these chemicals make their cells freeze really fast, so they don't have this popping, ice-popping phenomenon that I just described. But the chances of us being able to apply that to a human body right this second so that you can be brought back to life in the future, very, very unlikely.
But on that note of what you were speaking about, the egg or the embryo freezing, I haven't heard enough, and I don't know if from your experience if people don't speak enough about what can happen in the defrosting process to the quality of the egg or the quality of the embryo.
Originally, there was a time limit put on how long we could freeze these sorts of cells and tissues for. And now people have realized that having tested this very thoroughly indeed, there does not appear to be any deterioration in the quality of embryos which have been kept in a state of suspended animation in liquid nitrogen, which means about minus 200 degrees, from the day that they're frozen. Because people have done quite careful studies and they've looked at the success rates of reanimation. When you thaw these embryos and implant them, you get equal numbers of them taking root and producing a healthy offspring. So we're comfortable that when you take tissues that are optimally preserved and then keep them under ideal conditions like that, that there isn't a very rapid deterioration. And there doesn't appear to be any problems with embryos being frozen in this way. They seem to give rise to healthy individuals. We've got enormous numbers of IVF babies conceived from embryos that have been frozen, thawed out, put back into mum, and then mum has had a healthy baby or baby subsequently. So we're very comfortable that that's a safe method. But whether or not you will in the future be able to do this in a realistic way on a person who's already in bad health, because remember, if you most people are not going to volunteer for this when they're in good, rude health, are they? Because they're not going to say, freeze me tomorrow while I'm healthy so that you might be able to bring me back to life one day in the future, and then I'll be alive in the future and healthy. Most people say,
it's not going to happen.
That's a typical risk for me. I think I'll stick with today and the here and now, bad as it is in some cases.
All right, we have got, I think it's pronounced Rays from Johannesburg. Is it Rays? Hi. Race, is it pronounced race? Hello? Rais, my apologies. How are you, Rais? Rais? Okay, we seem to be having a challenge with that line there with Rais. More of your messages are coming through on the WhatsApp line 0727021702 when we come back from this break.
702. The Naked Scientist.
11 minutes to 3 o'clock. We're with The Naked Scientist, 011-883-0702, and the WhatsApp line 072-702-1702. We have Raiz from Johannesburg back again. Raiz, how are you doing?
Good, and you?
I am good, Raiz. How old are you?
I'm 8 years old.
Wonderful. So what question do you have for Dr. Chris Smith?
How does the sunlight reach the earth?
Oh, wow. Have you already started doing geography at school yet?
No.
But would you like to do geography?
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Chris Smith, how do the sun's rays or lights reach the earth?
Light is very special because light, which is produced by the sun and it comes in packets called photons, they don't need anything to travel through. They come straight through space and they reach the earth about 8 minutes after they leave the sun, because light travels very fast, 300,000 kilometers every second. So in other words, in 1 second, you've got, if light left South Africa, it could go all around the world and come back to South Africa 10 times in 1 second. And the light comes through space and it arrives on the Earth's surface and your eye sees it. And you're the only person that will ever see that bit of light from the sun, because the minute it goes into your eye, the energy in the light goes into your eye and makes you see it, and then no one else can.
Thank you so much, Raiz, for that question. Here's a question that's asking, Sid from Kempton Park says, why some diseases are chronic and some are not?
Yep. The answer to this is it really comes down to what the disease is and what the mechanism of the disease is. So if we take infections, where we mostly use the word acute or chronic, when you first have a disease, any disease, you are acutely infected. And then there are one of two outcomes. I suppose you could say three outcomes. The worst outcome is that you die. Well, you're not going to have chronic infection under those circumstances. But let's assume that you don't die and you recover. That's because your immune system has kicked in and it has dealt with the threat, neutralized it, and then the infection has gone away. Now you are recovered and hopefully immune, and you won't get it again, at least for a while. Another outcome is that the infection cannot be removed by the immune system. In the same way that some computer viruses are not able to be removed by even the best antiviral software, because they have ways of inveigling themselves into your operating system, some infections that we catch have ways of sidestepping immunity so that they are always present in the body. A good example of this from the virus world: hepatitis B, hepatitis C, HIV, blood-borne viruses. And they have various ways or mechanisms of inserting themselves into a situation beyond the reach of the immune system. So they persist, not in everybody, but in the vast majority of cases in HIV, some people in hepatitis B, especially young children, and a reasonably high number of people, probably 85% of people who run into hepatitis C, you have a chance of having a chronic infection. And it's because they have the ability to go beyond and around the reaches of the immune system. Tuberculosis is a bacterial infection that works a similar sort of way. So you're chronically infected, and the outcome of that can be a range of different things. In some people, there's a progression to more serious disease because the chronic presence of the infection continues to injure your tissues, and that then leads to a range of other secondary effects. In other cases, the immune system is capable of holding back the infection, so the degree of damage is limited, and while you have the infection, you're nevertheless healthy, and that can last for a variable amount of time. And HIV can do that to a certain extent, because you get HIV, you are very infectious when you're first infected, then the immune system becomes very good at controlling HIV for a while, and so you're relatively healthy for a while, and then the immune system begins to fail and the virus begins to win, and that's when you get AIDS, which is the immune deficiency manifesting as a whole raft of other infections coming in. And then there are other conditions that we describe as chronic because they're conditions that are not going to go away. Cancer is a chronic disease. You don't just wake up and your cancer's gone away. Arthritis, where you have stiff joints, swollen fingers, for example, is an inflammatory condition of the joints caused by wear and tear if you have osteoarthritis, or inflammatory changes because of the immune system if you have rheumatoid arthritis. Those are not going to go away anytime soon, so they are regarded as chronic arthritides. So the word acute means short term, fresh in onset, or it's about to go away. Chronic means it's been there for a long while, and it will really differ according to what sort of disease it is and what the mechanism of that disease is, how long that's going to be a problem for you.
Thank you so much for that question. Let's go to the lines. We have Kunashe. Kunashe, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am good. And how old are you?
I'm 10 years old.
Wonderful. What question do you have for Dr. Chris Smith?
So what I wanted to ask was, if you dig straight down through the earth and you get to the other side, which way will you face?
Ooh, okay. Interesting question. What subjects are you doing? Nice. Are you doing science at school?
No, not yet. I'm only in grade 5.
Oh, but you can't wait, I can tell.
Yeah.
Ah, wonderful, Kunashe. Doctor?
Well, brilliant question. And the answer is you'd have to be very good at digging, because the planet Earth, to get a tunnel from one side through the middle and out to the other side, your tunnel would have to be 12,000 kilometers long. So a really, really long tunnel. And the funny thing about the way gravity works, the thing that's holding your feet on the ground, and the reason that if you fall out of bed you hit the floor, is that gravity pulls you towards the center of the Earth. So if you fell into your tunnel, you would accelerate, going faster and faster and faster, assuming that there was no problem with heat and there was no problem with the air in the tunnel. We'll put that to one side. You would get to the middle of the tunnel and you'd be going top speed as soon as you got to the middle of the Earth. And you go flying through the middle of the Earth and out the other side of your tunnel towards the surface of the Earth, the other side. You'd slow down all the way to the other side, pointing in the same direction. So if you fell in, you'd be going in face first, and you therefore arrive at the other side looking out of your tunnel, but gravity would then be pulling you hard back the other way, so you'd just come to a stop on the other side, assuming no air resistance, etc., and then you'd fall all the way back again. And if nothing stopped you, you would bounce backwards and forwards between either side of the Earth for the rest of eternity.
Thank you so much, Kunashe, for that question. Then in a minute, Dr. Chris Smith, last week we had a conversation around people who were getting lifts from people, but they were saying, you're going there anyway, so I don't need to give you any petrol. And Farai is reminding us to say, how much, as a fractional percentage, does the weight of an average adult contribute to the fuel consumption of a car? So if I start giving you, Dr. Chris Smith, a lift in my car, and let's assume you weigh 80 kilograms, whatever that is in pounds, is it a significant increase in fuel consumption that one should justify charging somebody, even if they're going to exactly the same destination?
The way to think about this is how much of the proportion of the total vehicle weight is the passenger. So if you have a modest sized car and it weighs a ton and you weigh 100 kilos, you're about 10% of the mass of the car. So if you put two of you in there, then that's now about 10% you as well. So now your passengers are 200 kilos and the car is about a ton, so it's about a fifth. So you've doubled the amount of workload that the engine's got to do, because it's every time it goes up a hill, it's lifting you and your passengers up a hill. So it's fair enough to say they have significantly increased the workload on the car, therefore the fuel consumption, therefore they should not be so tight, and they should at the very least buy you a beer at the evening, or at best they should definitely dip in their pocket and hopefully have long enough fingers to reach the bottom to give you a few rands for your fuel.
I absolutely... You know what's crazy is that when your car is really filled to the brink, you can feel the weight when you are driving. Even the strongest of vehicles, you
and
really
some
can
of our
feel
passengers,
it.
We all know, don't we? they add more.
Yes. Thank you so much, Dr. Chris Smith. Back together again on Monday.